Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed can get you started with their online pre-registry, online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today, we're celebrating Thanksgiving with an American treasure. Jim Harrison is famous for his poetry, think Plain Songs, for instance, his novels, think Dalva, Legends of the Fall, and his screenwriting. Many people don't realize he's also a serious food writer. His new book is The Raw and the Cooked, Adventures of a Roving Gourmand. We get the scoop on an old-time American drink and a great alternative to wine with Thanksgiving dinner, fermented apple cider. British writer Jim Crace looks charity square in the eye. And then New Yorker and Gourmet magazine editor Ruth Reichel speculates about what Thanksgiving is going to be like in the city. And we're going to be doing what we do every week in the second half of the show. We're opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are ready to roll. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, if you're traveling along I-81 through Pennsylvania, it seems like there's nothing to eat. It's one of those highways with apparently no good food except for franchises. Get off at exit 36W in Frackville and go to a place called the Dutch Kitchen. From the outside, it looks like kind of an ordinary, quote, family-style restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Inside, it's the real seven sweets and seven sours and fabulous real Pennsylvania food.
It's hard to find really good Pennsylvania Dutch cooking. I mean, Michael and I have gone through all the, you know, Amish country in Pennsylvania and Indiana, and usually there are these giant kind of tourist places called, you know, Der Dutchman Essen Fressen House or something, and the food is just terrible. But the Dutch Kitchen actually has the real McCoy. It has honest-to-goodness made-from-scratch food, which is worth anybody taking at least a 25-mile detour off the highway to go to.
But and wait, you're going to have to explain something. What do you mean by the seven sweets and the seven sours?
Oh, well, this is, I guess you would call some sort of precursor to the salad bar. Seven sweets and seven sours is a whole table of kind of pickled and put up salads, preserves, red beets, chow chow, corn relish, what Italians would call giardiniera, an array of
those are the
relishes.
Sours. And then the seven sweets are seven different kinds of dessert or puddings.
Apple butter,
apple butter, anything that's sweet or anything that's sour.
But these are just side dishes. I mean, these just go alongside of like the hearty meal you're going to eat, which might be, for example, a ham stew with potatoes and cabbage and a side dish of handmade noodles. And then, of course, you top it off with that Pennsylvania Dutch specialty, shoe fly pie.
Wet bottom shoe fly pie.
Or dry bottom. They have both.
I like the wet bottom. That has a big ribbon of molasses at the bottom of it and this kind of eggy coffee cake-like crumbly top. The food here is so special because every single thing is made by hand. There was a period in time when the Dutch Kitchen, where Michael and I have been stopping here for probably 20 years whenever we're in Pennsylvania, had gone over to fake mashed potatoes.
Mm.
And this was a real black spot in the history of the Dutch Kitchen. And the owners, Tom and Jennifer Lekulik, had a couple of complaints about this, and now they're back to doing every single thing from the noodles to the potatoes to the pickled beets to the chow chow by hand, including baking their own bread fresh from the oven and their own tapioca pudding for dessert. It's just great home cooking.
Is this a big place?
Well, one of the great things about it is, from the outside, it looks like kind of an ordinary family-style restaurant. When you walk in, you realize that this ordinary family-style restaurant, which seats maybe 125 people, has inside of it an old-fashioned, beautiful monitor roof diner. It's as if the restaurant ingested the diner, which is, in fact, how the Dutch Kitchen began, as a small diner.
Lynn, you know that I'm a hardcore shopper, so one of the things I like about the Dutch Kitchen is you can take the chow chow and pickled beets and pickled eggs and apple butter home with you. They sell them put up in mason jars, and you can buy them to eat at home.
This sounds great.
But there's only one trouble with the Dutch Kitchen, and that is piercing has come to Frackville, Pennsylvania, body piercing. And the owners were telling us that, you know, they're trying to run this absolutely pristine, you know, homemade food establishment, you know, with red, white, and blue values and mom's apple pie. And they were having a terrible time hiring waitresses who weren't pierced. And it didn't quite go with the Amish food.
Life changes. The world
it
moves
does.
On.
Seven sweets, seven sours, and a couple of piercings.
And a couple of nose rings.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander through the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the
Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. You can hear them here every week on Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Got a new beverage for you to try this Thanksgiving. Now, it's got a great heritage, but most of us have never tasted it. It's fermented apple cider, and it can be like champagne. Thomas Jefferson and George Washington served this kind of cider to foreign dignitaries. Now there's a handful of new American cider makers. One of the pioneers is Steve Wood. He's a New Hampshire fruit grower who plowed up his apple orchard of sweet-tasting apples and planted apples that taste awful. These are the apples that he uses to make his Farnham Hill ciders. Steve, welcome to the Splendid Table.
Thank you very much.
So, Steve, what does this kind of cider taste like?
It tastes, when we are tasting it, analytically, we smell and taste tropical fruits, mango, passion fruit, sort of orange peels, a little bit of leather, all sorts of surprising aromas and flavors. But when you drink it, which is what we hope people will do, we don't expect them to analyze it and pull it apart. It is a little acidic, a little bit tannic, very fruity, but not the sort of fruit you would expect from an apple.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. I don't.
But you haven't said apples. I mean, you said it tastes like mangoes and all this other stuff, but you didn't say apples.
No, I haven't said apples because apples are more or less in the background. When apples ferment, or the right sort of apples ferment, a lot of other fruity aromas and flavors come to the fore. And the apple sort of drops into the background in the same way that the grape drops into the background in wine. People don't expect to taste fresh grapes in a Cabernet Sauvignon any more than we say they should expect to taste fresh apples in a well-made hard cider.
So how is this made? I mean, how is it different from sweet cider where you crush the apples and you've got the juice?
It starts the same way. We crush the apples and we've got the juice. But then it gets the kiss of the yeast, either in a barrel or in a tank. And it's fermented very much as wine is fermented, I guess a bit more like white wine than red wine. It ferments for somewhere between 2 weeks and 6 or 8 weeks, and then is matured either in stainless tanks or in oak barrels for another 6+ months before it goes into a bottle.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, how do you serve this?
In a glass.
is it served cold? Is it in a wine glass?
Well, it's a bit like white wine. It shouldn't be served ice cold, or you miss all of the lovely events. But we sort of serve it moderately chilled, and usually in a wine glass or in a smallish glass. It's not a long drink like beer.
Mm-hmm.
We think people generally drink it a little faster than wine, a little more slowly than beer.
It has less alcohol than wine, doesn't it?
It does indeed, yes. The alcohol levels of our ciders, at least, are usually in this sort of mid 7%, 7.5%, whereas wines tend to be up around 11 or 12.
What foods do you like with it?
Well, we like just about everything but desserts. We've tried it with everything from sushi to venison stew to hamburgers to cheese sandwiches. And it complements most dishes very nicely. Again, not sweeter dishes, but it's a bit more akin to red wine than white wine, despite the way it looks. It's got a broader tannic structure than most white wines. But we haven't found very many foods we don't like to drink it with.
So it sounds like it's really a good idea with what happens on the Thanksgiving table with all those tastes that battle each other.
You bet.
Well, aside from your own cider, are there others you could suggest to us, some other names to look for?
Oh, sure. There are a handful. I'll give you a couple. Terry and Judith Maloney make a nice cider, very different from ours, in western Massachusetts, in Coleraine, at a place called West County Winery. And there's a fellow called Alan Foster who makes what's called white oak cider on the West Coast. If people are looking for good American hard ciders or good American fermented ciders, I think probably the best suggestion would be that they look for cider made by the person who grew the fruit, because those are the people who are going to be most likely to respect the apples and try to bring the apples in a jolly way into the bottle.
For those who have tasted fermented ciders in Europe, like in Normandy or in England, are these ciders similar to those ciders?
Well, they are and they aren't. Our ciders are not imitative of French, that is, Norman and Brittany ciders, any more than they are of the Devon and Somerset Farm ciders of England. They are all related in the way that wine is all related. But if you've tasted Moselle, that doesn't give you a sense of what a good heavy Burgundy would be like. And our ciders are different. They tend to be a bit more acidic than French ciders, and a bit sort of cleaner and fruitier than the ciders of the southwest of England. They're the ciders of our hillside.
They're American ciders.
They are American ciders, but I think it's a great liberating fact in the U.S. that cider makers do not have a range of expectations they've got to meet, as they would do in the north of France, say.
Mm-hmm.
We can make cider to our taste, and our effort is to make our ciders reflective of the lovely fruit we grow on these hillsides in northern New Hampshire.
Well, Steve Wood, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
Steve Wood makes Farnham Hill ciders. Now, these fermented ciders may be hard to find. Check your local shops to see if they can help you out. To get information on the ciders that Steve mentioned, go to our website. That's splendidtable.org. Coming up, poet and novelist Jim Harrison talks food. We've Charity Unmasked and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here on The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. writer Jim Harrison has been called the Homer, the Michelangelo, and the Willie Mays of words. The fact is, Jim Harrison is simply a writer's writer. If you want to know the ropes of poetry, fiction, screenplays, essays, you read Jim Harrison. And then there's his food writing. Now, when it comes to eating, he says he thinks of himself as a private detective of food, ceaselessly searching for the genuine. Under his trench coat, a bib, instead of a gun, he carries toothpicks, Pepto-Bismol, and a fairly large wallet. Jim Harrison's latest book is a collection of his food writings, The Raw and the Cooked. Jim, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Jim, how did you start writing about food?
I'm not so sure. I think it was for a little magazine that asked me to write something, and it occurred to me, why not? I'd always had a goodly portion of food in my novels under the assumption that people do eat two or three times a day, and too often a kind of a high literary novel leaves it out. You know, whereas French novels, for instance, or continental novels that I like a lot, naturally, you don't just say we had lunch without saying what you had for lunch. So it started small and then took over for a while. You know, I became, as all my enthusiasms tend to become, obsessions. And I enjoyed the freedom of it, too, you know.
What do you mean by the freedom of it?
Well, it was just the idea. I never wrote restaurant reviews or anything. I wrote more along the lines of the theory and practice of food. My Esquire columns were those, you know, about food as being part of the total life rather than something you could separate into one of those precious little pieces we used to read in food magazines that you weren't sure were written even by a human being or an android, you know. Right.
Well, do you cook?
Oh, yes, of course, yeah. I've always thought, I've told friends that if you want your marriage to last longer, split the cooking.
So who is the king or the queen of the kitchen in your house?
Oh, I think I said in that one essay on American food that it mystified me that after nearly 40 years of living with her, no matter how hard I work, she's still by far the better cook.
Why is this?
I'm not sure. I think it's because writers tend to get excited about very minor triumphs. You know, I mean, if it's even edible, they think they're marvelous.
Well, now you write, though, about doing a lot of cooking with men when you're hunting.
That's a tradition, you know, like over the years I've used a lot of Paula Wolfert duck recipes and so on from the sud-west of France. Since we're only hunting about a month, we don't permit anything ordinary, you know.
So this is serious stuff.
Well, I like that idea of 11 places where we have, for instance, a very large garden. And I like to eat the food I can gather, hunting and fishing, you know. And as we've, so much of beef is suspect these days that even I have to be attentive of where and how I get my beef. But Gary Snyder, the poet, said something fascinating, that often there's a presumed virtue by people who maintain a distance from the sources of their food. And where I'd rather get my own, I would rather eat a couple grouse, say from Minnesota's North Shore, than I would to eat chickens who have never seen daylight. You know that problem.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think many ways I grew up as a Pleistocene biped up in northern Michigan, and that's what I still am. In my own family, it's extraordinary. My uncles, my grandparents, no one ever spoke of hunting as manly. You get what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just something you did.
Uh-huh.
In the fall, you hunted. All summer, you fished. And we all loved eating all of this. Nobody talked in those Hemingway terms, this is how you become a man. And all that. I don't remember a single word of that sort growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm writing a memoir but I'm going to take a long time. It's about half done. In the first section is a long early life, and then I cover a lot of dreadful years of commuting to Hollywood, which makes good memoir fodder, you know.
So, Jim, you're going to write about food again?
Well, yes, I can't stop totally. Every time I thought I'd stop last year, and then Michael Ondaatje, you know, who wrote The English Patient, mm-hmm. we were talking in Chicago, and he said, would you write a little essay for my literary magazine in Toronto about spaghetti and meatballs? Because we were talking about the proper spaghetti and meatball recipe. So I couldn't help but write that, you know, like a crank. Yes, you must do it this way or forget it, you know. So I can't quite stop. And I even write about wine. I've been writing about wine recently for Kermit Lynch's catalog. He's an importer, and I've been drinking a lot of Cote de Rhones rather than Burgundies and Bordeaux since I quit the screen business. So I write that, and then you can't talk about wine unless you also talk about what you ate with the wine. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
They can't be. And what were you were doing? Were you in your cabin? Had you just walked your dog? What you were reading? You know, that's why I write about food. I mean, I can't separate it from the rest of the life.
Keep it up. We need it.
Well, I evidently can't stop, and it's too late to become a cowboy.
Jim, thank you.
You're welcome.
Jim Harrison's collection of his food writings is The Raw and the Cooked. His new book of novellas is The Beast God Forgot to Invent. This is the time of year when food shelves are beckoning. It's always been an easy way to give. You simply slip a can or a jar in the bin. We don't spend much time thinking about our choice. Well, perhaps we should. Jim Crace, author of The Devil's Larder, has a tale of a small town, a family of refugees, and the town's pantries.
Ours is a little town of great historic charity. In the last 6 months alone, public subscription has put a new roof on the medieval chapel and planted a garden for the blind and raised the money to buy a touring bus for the use of local schools. We have made holiday provisions for 15 pensioners and sent coach parties to the zoo. The park is somewhat overburdened with cedar benches and flowering trees donated to the town by dutiful relatives in memory of a parent or a child. The Cottage Art Museum up in the Pines has just acquired a small Matisse thanks to the efforts of our citizens. So it ought to come as no surprise that when three refugee families were dumped like sodden cargo on the docks one night, they were quickly offered temporary housing in the block behind the port by the Association for the Poor. And somebody, she much prefers to stay unnamed, began to organise a cart, in other words, the open trailer used by the private school for taking camping expeditions to the hills, was draped with lights and dragged around the better streets by some of the older pupils to gather food for our new visitors. To start it off, the one who wants to stay unnamed went to her own larder and removed a large and almost full jar of mixed pickles. Her husband, a heartburn martyr and the owner of the school, could not, she was weary of reminding him, risk eating pickles any more. She cleaned the inside of the glass rim with a cloth, disguised the pierced jar top with a cap of green muslin held in place by a matching rubber band, and put her offering onto the cart. The boarding master, a divorcee of 18 months, came out from his flat and rid himself at last of his wife's exotic teas. The first house that they reached provided half a dozen tins of fruit in heavy syrup. Glad to help, the woman said. She was a kilo overweight and had determined only that morning to cut down on sugary desserts. The next house offered a packet of unpopular breakfast cereal, hardly touched, and the next a cellophane packet of spaghetti shapes, which had hardened and lost much of their colour in the month since they'd been bought. The second street quickly yielded its offerings of rusty tins, odd-smelling packets thought too old to use, flat lemonade, three cartons of 45 meals for the elderly, no longer needed by a recently buried aunt, yogurt well beyond its date, the unused ingredients of two ambitious meals, unwanted gifts, imported goods with no translation on the label, hasty choices, past mistakes. And so on, downtown from the school, street after street, until the cart was overloaded with our charity and had become the oddest shopping trolley in the world. Here is the photograph. The pupils are lined up behind the cart. Three little waifs are posing on their month of meals. The owner of the school is shaking hands with a wildly grinning refugee. The caption says, "The town donated 200 kilos to its unfortunate guests." And that's not counting all the problems solved, and all the larders tidied up at last, the heartburns eased, the diets honoured, the separations finalised, and the blunders of the past concealed as gifts.
That was Jim Crace reading from his new book, The Devil's Larder. Jim Crace lives and writes in Birmingham, England.
Come on home and be welcome to stay. Baby, don't you come home.
September 11th changed America's sense of New York City and New Yorkers. People who've never lived there thought of New York as almost another country. I think most of us feel differently now. With the Thanksgiving holiday approaching, we've been thinking about what it will be like in that city. And we've asked Ruth Reichel, New Yorker and editor of Gourmet Magazine, to join us. Ruth, hello.
Hi, good to be here.
Boy, if ever there was a time to check in with New Yorkers, what's Thanksgiving going to be like for New Yorkers this year?
I think this is going to be the most meaningful Thanksgiving that any of us can remember. We all feel like we really have a lot to be thankful for. This is a meal that, I don't know, I feel like over the past few years it's gotten glitzy and, you know, people were going out to restaurants a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people had sort of lost touch with what it was really about. And this year, you really have a sense that people are gathering together. In my case, we have done Thanksgiving the day after Thanksgiving for years because everybody had to be with their families and we had a second day Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I remember you wrote about this.
Right.
Yeah.
And this year, suddenly we had all these friends from not only the West Coast, but also from Europe, who called and said they wanted to come to Thanksgiving here in New York with us. And so I have a house full of people on Thanksgiving for the first time in years. I think, you know, our friends from out of town are, you know, wanting to show us, you know, how much they care about us.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're really wanting to have the kind of warmth of family. And, you know, people are, you know, have ordered their turkeys early. I mean, I went to sign up for my organic turkey and it was like the 1st of November and there was already a huge list of people that signed up for turkeys.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are, you know, swapping recipes early. And everybody I know is having 30 people for Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, it's really thrilling for me because this is the secular food holiday. And I feel like people are really using it well this year.
You were just putting the November issue to bed on September 11th. What's changed in that issue?
Well, you know, fortunately, it being a Thanksgiving issue, it was mostly sort of America and food, so we didn't have to change a lot. The single big change was we had a fabulous piece by Mahdar Jaffrey, whom we had sent to Pakistan. And that did not seem totally appropriate. So we put it aside for a few months and ran a piece about the great forgotten American National Park, Big Bend National Park, which is a wonderful place in Texas. And we just thought, you know, for right now, we're going to put this in instead and really sort of stay home for this holiday.
Well, I think in our heads and maybe in our hearts, a lot of us will be around your tables this year. Thanks a lot, Ruth.
Well, we will welcome you. Thank you.
Ruth Reichel is editor of Gourmet Magazine. You know, I've been cooking a lot lately, more than usual. It's no surprise. Look, this is at least something you can attempt to control. What I've been making instinctively is curious, though. A lot of dishes from the Arab world. It's almost as though I'm trying to write a peace treaty in my kitchen. Now, last night, for instance, it was an improvised Moroccan chicken. Well, it occurred to me it would make good Thanksgiving turkey as well. So I thought I'd share it with you. What it really is a sauce that's a seasoning, and you can do it in a blender. It's called charmoula. And what you do is you puree together lots of garlic and lemon, a big handful of fresh coriander, and paprika with olive oil. You rub it all over the bird, and you slip some under the skin. Well, look, don't try to write this down. I've done the recipe, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org. And figuring that, you know, this is the big cooking week for all of us, we have got a ton of information on the website, including probably the single most requested recipe we've seen so far this year, how to brine a turkey. Cooks Illustrated was kind enough to share their formula, and it's up on our website. The great thing, though, about cooks is you know they get it right. They test and test and test. So go to the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it is now time for our weekly food question. And the question is, what can run faster than an Olympic champ and turns blue when it mates? We'll have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We'll be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. That number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's food question. It was, what can run faster than an Olympic champ and turns blue when it mates? Come on, you've guessed this, right? It's a wild turkey. You knew this all the time. Now, the fact is that a full-grown wild turkey can run 55 miles an hour. And its head occasionally turns blue when it mates. I think all of this adds up to not a very pretty picture for those pilgrims. Now, there's no actual record that they ate turkey on the first Thanksgiving. And that's no surprise. I mean, think about this. Between the speed and the blue head, I'd stick to cod or pickled pumpkin or whatever the neighbors brought for potluck.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we'll talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Tom on the line. Hey, Tom, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I wanted to ask this question. I'm the cook for my family. I've got a daughter who's 5 and a son who's 3. And I'm calling because my wife is allergic to all poultry of any form. And so I'm always looking for alternatives to poultry, but especially with Thanksgiving coming here, I'm in need of finding an alternative, and I've lately been thinking about rabbit. My problem is I don't know a thing about rabbits at all. Like, I don't know where I would buy them, and once I've gotten there, how do I know I've gotten a good one? And I've heard some dark rumors about diseases a person can get by handling rabbit. And then finally, I guess the most basic question of all is, how do you cook one of those things once you got it? And then I guess after I cook it, what do you tell a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old about what they're eating? Final thing.
First of all, it is so. To me, I'm so glad to hear someone wanting to know about cooking rabbit, because most of the rest of the world knows that it's lean, it's healthy. In a lot of parts of the world, it's very inexpensive, and it's great eating. And, yeah, you do have the problem. It's the Easter Bunny thing.
Exactly.
You know, Julia Child once said, boy, if there weren't any Easter Bunnies around, people would have been eating rabbit in this country for years. Let's start at the beginning. First of all, often you find rabbit frozen in your supermarket because it just doesn't sell very quick. And I would check dates on it, because sometimes it's been there since before the last ice age.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, where do you live?
In St. Louis.
Oh, you're in a big city.
Mm-hmm.
I would, you know what I would do? I would check some of the specialty markets in your area.
Okay.
And call them and say, hey, can you guys get me some fresh rabbit?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may run a little pricey because it's just, you know, there's not enough of it sold, so it tends to be pricey.
Okay.
I don't know about the problems of handling the rabbit, but if there are problems, it's probably more about handling rabbit that has the skin on and all that business. You know, anything can have salmonella or E. coli.
Mm-hmm.
You have to wash it well. You make sure that you use a special cutting board for any meat and that kind of stuff. But when it comes to cooking rabbit, this is what you've got. You've got lean meat. The thighs, like a chicken, tend to be darker, a little moister. The whole area of the body, the loin, you know, sort of running from the shoulder all the way back to where the thigh begins, is whiter and very tender. And if you want to roast the whole thing, which would be delicious, one of the things you do with it is you roast it slow. So there's a recipe I did, I found really, and I put in my first cookbook, The Splendid Table. And it's rabbit that you baste with melted butter, lemon, and white wine. And you throw a few sprigs of rosemary in the pan and garlic. And essentially, you take this, you sprinkle it with salt and pepper, you put it in a 400-degree oven for about 10 minutes just to give it a little sear. And then you turn the oven down to about 325, and you roast it slow, and you keep basting it. You've slathered it with butter, by the way,
mm-hmm.
which never has hurt anything, because this meat is so lean, you see. But you keep basting, you know, and you add a little wine, you add a little lemon, you rub it, if you want to rub it, with half a lemon. And when the thigh reads about 170 degrees on an instant reading thermometer,
mm-hmm.
it's done. And the average rabbit is just a thin shell of meat, so it's going to take an hour maybe. Now, another thing, and I think it's a great idea for Thanksgiving.
Oh, good. And so, Lynn, is this like chicken where you don't want to undercook it?
That's right.
Okay.
Exactly. And the slow cooking tends, whenever you have meat you think might be chewy because it's very lean, slow cooking is one of the ways you keep it very tender.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So try that, and you know, put it on a bed of fresh rosemary with some clusters of grapes around it. It'll be lovely.
That sounds really nice. Yeah.
And call it lapin or coniglio. In fact, the children might want to know it as Cornelio.
Oh, that's very helpful.
All right.
That'll be one of those things when they're adult in a therapist's office. They'll tell on me, you know, and they'll say that he used to use these other words.
Yes, well, Daddy lied, but Daddy didn't lie.
Yeah.
Hey, and happy Thanksgiving. What a great husband to want to do this for your wife.
Thank you.
Take
happy
care,
Thanksgiving
Tom.
Thanksgiving to you, too.
You, too. Bye.
Bye.
Isn't that a great alternative at Thanksgiving? Well, I'm going to post the recipe on the website. It's called Giovanna's Wine Basted Rabbit. Now, talking about alternatives to traditions, I've got an idea for pumpkin pie. I do this every year. I found out that if you make pumpkin from scratch, you know, for your pumpkin pie, I know that's a little fanatical, but the reality is I don't think pumpkin tastes all that great. What does taste great is butternut squash. And I just roast it. I cut it in half, put it on a cookie sheet. You know, I oil the sheet. Whatever, and roast it at 400 until I can easily pierce it with a knife, cool it down, scoop it out, puree it, and that's what I make my pie with. And there's another trick. After you've spiced the pie, if you want to make it so mellow, throw in about 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract, you know, for a 9 or 10 inch pie. And speaking of pie, I've got a trick for apple pie. You can make it deep and sweet tart. Add, for standard apple pie, 9 or 10 inches, about 1/3 cup of cider syrup. Now you might say, what do you mean by cider syrup? This is something you make just by boiling. Take a couple of quarts of really good organic cider and boil it down until you can coat a spoon with it. This is going to be so good. It's deep and it sort of resonates with sweet tart. I keep it in the freezer. I use it over grilled fish. I put it over turkey. I use it in sauces. And, of course, it's great over ice cream, cake, and all that stuff. So, about 1/3 cup cider syrup in with your apple pie. Okay, let's get back to the calls. By the way, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Who's up? We've got Jeff calling. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi there, Lynn.
Yeah?
I've spoken to you before. You're the one that helps me plan my cocktail parties that I have.
We just got your package. Is this Jeff who did the spy party?
Yes, this year's theme was I Spy Cocktails. I always pick themes that somehow represent the 50s or the 60s, so there's, you know, sort of a nostalgic quality to them.
I have to tell everybody, this package just arrived, and we've all been looking at it together. Jeff gave this I Spy party, and the return address on his invitation, I'm going to pull it out right now, because I just was looking at this, International Man of Mystery Headquarters.
Well, that's a reference to Austin Powers, and he was sort of my, you know, update version on the spy theme.
This is really a rather timely party. I mean, did you have any hesitation about doing it?
Well, yeah, I almost canceled it. It was scheduled for September 30th, and September didn't seem like a great month to have a party, but
right.
My friends really wouldn't let me cancel it. They, you know, this is a time when people actually need to get together and need to have some kind of, you know, some kind of fun
yeah,
in their life.
Yeah.
So the social aspect of it was wonderful. And the spy theme didn't seem to taint it too much. You know, it wasn't like some kind of a war theme exactly. It was more James Bond and, you know, the Avengers or the Mod Squad or something like that. So,
well, just from Jeff sent photographs. And first of all, you know, anything that gets men into black tie. Hey, this is gorgeous. So you had I Spy eggs, which were eggs that actually had eyes made out of olives on them and stuff like that, right?
They were like deviled eggs, yeah. And with the olive slice and then a caper on top of that, it did kind of look like an eye. Yeah. Now, but see, then there was salmon in that egg, too. So all the food had some kind of secret ingredient in it, and people were supposed to taste it and then tell me what they thought, you know, was in it.
This
and
is great.
And then the answers were written inside matchbooks that were placed next to the food item.
But
people were very nervous. They didn't really want to play the game, and they cheated all over the place. And they would look before they tasted just because they were nervous about what was going to be in it. So
we
that
hate
didn't
tests.
Always work out.
We hate tests, don't we? Okay, what's next, Jeff?
Next year?
Yeah.
Well, I'm still considering some themes, but I might do sort of a Western theme, cocktail roundup, and, you know, reference Gene Autry and Roy Rogers and Howdy Doody and Patsy Cline, I guess, and, you know, Bonanza. So I'm thinking about doing that one next year. There's probably a lot of, you know, barbecued food for that one.
Well, we can all come on horseback.
Oh, now that'd be great. Yeah, I'll put a hitching post out front.
And I can sing my favorite song, Ain't You a New Buckaroo.
Oh, well, please send me a recording of that. I'll have to start collecting the music for this one.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for sending the invitation and the recipes and the photos.
You bet.
This is the Splendid Table Party Planning Service.
Oh, great. Well, I'll be calling you next year. Don't worry about that.
Okay. Hey, Jeff, thanks.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
You guys should see the photos. Everybody's in formal evening dress. You know, the guys are in black tie. It is just incredible. Well, you know, Jeff reminds me of something I've been thinking a lot about. I think we should use the Splendid Table Forum to start a dialogue about how food's playing in our lives these days. What are you cooking for yourself? What are you cooking for your friends or your family? And what foods are lifting your spirits? I mean, are you hitting McDonald's a lot more than you normally would? Let's go to the Splendid Table Forum. I'm going to be there a lot, and let's talk. And let's share recipes and what's happening with food. You can get there by going to splendidtable.org. Okay, let's get back to the phones. Let's see, that number is 800-537-5252. But who's up? We've got Lars on the line. So, Lars, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you today?
I am swell, sir. You sound pretty chipper. What's on your mind?
Well, you're talking about Thanksgiving ideas.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And one that I have used for both Thanksgiving and Christmas is a Moroccan dish called farakmaamer.
I beg your pardon.
Absolutely, and I didn't get any on me.
What is it?
It is a Moroccan dish, which is pigeons with couscous stuffing. Now, pigeons are not exactly my idea of food, so I use Rock Cornish game hens instead.
Uh-huh.
And they are stuffed with couscous, with chopped fruits and chopped nuts, you know, raisins, dates, apricots, whatever you want to put in.
What could be bad? This sounds great.
And almonds or pistachios, cloves, cinnamon, and so forth. And I make one bird per person, and I then have no need to worry about making turkey hash or turkey sandwiches for the next month and a half. So it's absolutely delicious dinner.
Yeah, this is a great idea, especially if you have a very small Thanksgiving. And there are, it's hard to believe, I know, but there are people who aren't nuts about turkey or, as you say, about leftovers. So do you roast these or do you braise them? What do you do with the hens?
They're actually, what you do is you stuff the birds.
Right.
And they're cooked in a Dutch oven with about an inch of water with some spices and some onions in it.
Oh,
and
lovely.
You turn the birds. And there's always extra stuffing, and it's absolutely delicious. And I've served anything from 2 people to 20 people doing this.
This sounds absolutely delicious. And one of the great things about something like a couscous stuffing, if the birds are just warm as opposed to piping hot when you serve it, it still tastes great.
Absolutely. And the birds stay moist very nicely, as they do with any stuffing.
Hey, Lars, thanks. This is a great idea for any time.
Okay.
Hey, thank you, sir.
Thank you, and aloha.
Aloha. Wait a minute. Hold it. Stop right there. We have a dish I can't pronounce from Morocco, and your name is Lars. And what are you saying to me?
Aloha.
Talk about fusion. Hawaii, Lars, and a Moroccan dish. Okay. Take care, Lars.
Okay, thanks. And you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. And we would really love to talk to you, no matter what the question is. We've got Ann calling. So, Ann, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about mashed potatoes.
Mashed
potatoes.
Okay.
I'm doing Thanksgiving dinner and have a lot of different dishes, and I hate to do everything at the last minute and to get it all on the table hot. I'd like to do some things ahead of time, and I'm wondering if you have a good recommendation to be able to do the mashed potatoes ahead of time and keep them hot. I hate cold mashed potatoes. They've got to be hot and not get gluey or whatever.
Well, I'll tell you a couple of things. And this, I have to tell you, I'm so glad somebody has asked this question because, you know, I'm one of those people who reads food science to go to sleep at night. And I just was reading about this from our favorite food scientist, Shirley Currier. She wrote something about this.
Okay.
Do you know that the best, first of all, let me answer the first part of your question first. Yes, I do my mashed potatoes ahead. I put them in a casserole, in a shallow casserole, so they'll reheat fast. And I do them a day ahead, and then I put them in the oven. And I reheat them in the oven just before they go to the table. Because like you, who has time the last minute? But the gummy question,
yeah.
You know, how do you get fluffy, wonderful mashed potatoes? I have figured it out because I got the code from Shirley. This is the deal. You want to start out with things like russet potatoes because they have to have a lot of starch. Now, starch granules swell, therefore give you fluffy, lovely mashed potatoes, when you cook the potatoes at a low temperature. So what you do is you slice the potatoes about a half inch thick, You put them into the water and you keep them below the simmer. And you do that for 20 minutes, and they're not going to cook all the way.
Well, so you're not boiling them like I normally think of.
It's a two-step process. Follow me on this one. This is very clever. Now, the next thing you do is you drain them and you chill them. Because by chilling that starch, you firm it up and stabilize it so it can't gum. Isn't this interesting?
Oh.
And then when you're ready to actually mash them, you throw them back in boiling water and you simmer them until they're tender. And then you dry them, you know, you drain them really well to get rid of excess moisture, and you mash them. And at that point, stick them in the refrigerator, which, at least from where I sit, would further stabilize the starch. And, of course, you never do them in a food processor because no matter what you do, the food processor will turn the starch to gum.
Yeah.
You know, you mash them in a food mill or you can mash them with a masher. But I do my mashed potatoes ahead of time all the time for dinner parties and stuff like that and reheat them in the oven, you know, 375 for 20 minutes.
Okay.
Which is usually the time I'm slicing something or getting it into the pan or, you know, whatever.
Okay.
But isn't that a great idea? Two-step process and you can do it ahead.
Yeah, I'll try that. Great.
Okay. Hey, thank you. I've been waiting for somebody before I forgot this all. I've been waiting for somebody to ask.
Well, great. Well, thanks very much for your help.
Hey, thanks for a great question. Have fun.
Okay.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.
Hey, guys, we're running out of time, but I really got to tell you about gravy. Okay, three gravy secrets. First of all, how to get rid of the lumps or not have them to begin with. Your thickener is usually flour. This is what I do. You put 2 tablespoons of flour in a tall glass, and you add 1 cup of cold water, and you add it slowly, and you beat it in with a fork. The idea is your thickener always has liquid added to it. You never add your thickener to liquid because that's how you get lumps. And then what you do is you pour that mixture in and you boil it in the pan. How to get great gravy flavor? Okay. Take those pan drippings, put them over 2 burners on top of the stove, pour 1 cup of wine in there, scrape and boil and scrape up the juices and boil until the wine's almost gone. Then add broth, then add the thickener, boil until you can't taste flour. Got it? Easy. Don't season with salt and pepper until after you've done all of that, and it's going to taste great. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Have a great Thanksgiving. Join us again next week. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Oscar Wilde. After a good dinner, one can forgive anybody, even one's own relatives. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.